Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the future of the Syrian conflict and the question of whether a peaceful resolution is possible. In this hour, we'll hear from Herrera Balian. He's director of the Conflict Resolution Program at the Carter Center. He's in conversation with Katie Zoglin. She's senior deputy city attorney of the city of San Jose. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Katie Zoglin.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming out this evening. And I'm going to briefly introduce the topic for this evening as well as our guests. The Syrian conflict, as you may know, started off in the spring of 2011, and it has expanded to become a humanitarian crisis, not only in Syria, but its neighboring countries, and even has expanded beyond those borders to Europe. Approximately half of the Syrian population is displaced within the country. Over 4.5 million people have fled the country. And over 270,000 people have been killed in the conflict during the past 5 years. Violence continues notwithstanding the cessation of hostilities, that is called, that has been in place since February of this year. At the same time, many countries are working to try to promote peace, but at the same time, others are not. Given this context, is there a pathway to peace? And if so, what would that look like? How would that be shaped? And who might lead the country in the future? Tonight's discussion will focus on those issues. And we're very fortunate to have here with us Herrera Balian, who is with the Carter Center and heads the Conflict Resolution Program. Since 2008, he has been responsible for overseeing the Carter Center's efforts to monitor global conflicts and for coordinating initiatives in the Middle East. He also has extensive experience working with non-governmental organizations and intergovernmental organizations in the Balkans, Eastern Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. Would you join me, please, in welcoming Herrera Balian?
Thank you.
Perhaps we could start off with just giving a context of the high diplomatic level, what peace process is going on or discussions are going on at this time.
If I may, let me start first by setting the stage as to where Syria is today. You mentioned 270,000 people killed. Well, actually, the number of killed is approaching 500,000. Those figures are old, 250,000, 270,000. Just yesterday, the special envoy for the UN to Syria mentioned the figure 400,000 killed for the first time. And as you know, the UN is extremely conservative organization in terms of throwing around numbers. But the numbers are closer to 500,000. And there are over 2 million people who have been injured and maimed in this conflict. If you put those two figures together, 500,000 killed and more than 2 million injured, that's 2.5 million people who have been directly, personally affected by this conflict. That's 10% of the population. Given this, we've been extremely pessimistic for the past 5 years as to where this conflict is heading. Frankly, we all thought that this would be a 10 to 15 year conflict before it abates. But in October last year, we started to see dim lights on the horizon towards a resolution of this conflict.
And why that timing?
Yeah. The dim lights appeared when the international community finally came to the conclusion, and in particular four countries came to the conclusion that this cannot continue anymore. This conflict cannot continue anymore because a number of reasons. It cannot continue anymore because of ISIS, or as I prefer to call Daesh. The Arabic acronyms for the organization that is causing mayhem, really, not only in Syria and Iraq, but, as you know, in Europe, Brussels, Paris, etc. And we haven't seen the end of it yet. That has caused, when this mayhem was transported to Europe, Europeans start pressing for a resolution. when the refugees last summer started invading Europe. As you know, 600,000-800,000 Syrian refugees invaded Europe last summer through the fall. That prompted the Europeans to say, enough is enough, we've got to stop this. And fortunately, the US and Russia took the leadership of the international community and pressed the international community towards a solution. And in Vienna, and also to include everyone involved in the conflict, including Iran, that had been excluded from any discussions on a resolution to the conflict up until October. In October, for the first time, everyone involved in the conflict came around the table in Vienna, and in two meetings developed a minimum consensus on how this conflict could end, which translated in December into a UN Security Council resolution, which put forward an 18-month process through which to build, to move from the war setting into a peace process, a transition in Syria.
And could you give us an overview of what that 18-month process envisions?
Yeah. The first step in the process is to start what you mentioned already, the cessation of hostilities. It's really a ceasefire. And for the first time in 5 years, we saw a nationwide, countrywide ceasefire take hold in Syria. The countries that were sponsoring the various sides, and it's not two sides, right? It's not just opposition and the regime, it's various sides in Syria. The countries that were arming and financing this war through their proxies in Syria were tasked with the job of stopping their proxies from fighting and convincing their proxies to respect the ceasefire, the cessation of hostilities. And only then the cessation of hostilities became successful very quickly, to a point where now 2 months into it, it started towards the end of February, last days of February, and 2 months into it, we have statistical evidence to show that violence has been reduced and continues to be reduced despite all the alarmist articles and news information that we hear on a daily basis. Violence has been reduced between 85 and 90% throughout the country. There are still very difficult areas around Aleppo, Idlib, and near Damascus. But by and large, the violence has been reduced between 85 to 90% in the country. And this has permitted humanitarian organizations to start delivering humanitarian assistance to communities that had been deprived of any humanitarian assistance for the past 4 or 5 years. Violence was reduced to a level where people started taking up again the protests against the government, as well as against the extremist organizations, the jihadist organizations that have taken hold of large parts of the country. They started protesting against this organization for the first time in 5 years. So civil action, political space started opening up. I mean, you know, let's not exaggerate now. I shouldn't call it political space. Some civil action at very high risk to the people who took part in it started taking place again, because of the cessation of hostilities. And the cessation of hostilities allowed, finally, for all the parties, pressed by their supporters, external supporters, to come into Geneva and start the negotiation process. Now, we're not there yet. There are huge obstacles, huge issues that have not been resolved. But negotiations have started. And talking is the beginning of a peace process. And we're there. And this is supposed to be, the UN put forward an 18-month process that is supposed to see, beyond the cessation of hostilities, a negotiated power-sharing arrangement between the government, the regime of Bashar al-Assad and his allies, and some of the opposition elements who have been fighting against the government. So they're supposed to form a power-sharing arrangement. We're nowhere near that yet. Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov announced 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, that he wants this in place by August the latest. Inshallah, as we say in the Middle East.
For the power-sharing agreement to
be in
place.
For the power-sharing arrangement.
Yeah.
And another step in the Security Council resolution peace plan is that within 18 months, Syria is supposed to see a new constitution, a new democratic constitution. I dare not say democratic, but that's what the resolution calls for. But a constitution which will allow the power sharing arrangement to be based on a constitutional framework.
Has the Syrian regime said that it would be open to a power-sharing agreement?
Well, this is the Security Council resolution that obligates the Syrian regime to agree to the power-sharing arrangement, the constitution, and eventually, at the end of the 18-month period, to new elections, more democratic than the country has ever seen. Now, we have a situation where still the opposition is demanding maximum change, and the government that is willing to do less than minimum change. What's going to allow these two parties to come closer and put in place the necessary, sufficient change to allow the transition to take place is their sponsors. Russia is very, very serious about pushing this political process forward. The U.S. is very serious about pushing the political process forward. U.S. and Russia, with their allies, respective allies, have influence on the various sides fighting in Syria and arguing in Syria. It's going to be up to them, first, to make sure that the ceasefire holds, and second, to make sure that their various sponsored sides would, in fact, reluctantly put in place the changes necessary to put the country in a transitional process. Now, all of this is easier said than done, obviously. There are lots of spoilers, including some of the countries in the neighborhood who have been playing the spoiler role, and they have not stepped back yet and, so to speak, seen the light change their behavior.
Which countries would you put in that?
Yeah. Turkey is one.
And what is
it? Has been playing a spoiler role.
And what are its interests or its goals in the manner?
Turkey has sponsored and supported some of the most destructive forces in the Syrian conflict on the opposition side, some of the most jihadist forces in the opposition side. Turkey has allowed its borders to be used for ISIS recruits to come into the country almost free up until about 6 months ago. Now they're trying to restrict it. Turkey has two interests. Turkey does not want to see Assad survive in any way, shape, or form. And secondly, more importantly for Turkey, Turkey does not want to see the Kurds in Syria to get any level of autonomy in the country, which would be then inspiring the Kurds in Turkey, with which they are in conflict, have been in conflict for the past year, to be encouraged or develop cooperation between the two sides.
What role has the Carter Center been playing in any of these discussions or behind the scenes?
From the very beginning of this conflict, we were very alarmed by the fact that the international community had written off the Assad regime, and expecting the Assad regime to disappear from the face of the earth as the Mubarak in Egypt did, Ben Ali in Tunisia and Yemen and Gaddafi in Libya did. We kept saying to the international community, we know Syria, we've been working there in Syria with the regime and the opposition for a number of decades, number of years now. And we kept telling the international community, including Washington, that Assad is not going anywhere. Let's not write him off so quickly. Try to engage him and involve him in a transitional process. Unfortunately, no one in Washington listened to that, and they wrote him off. And they cut off all relations together with the Europeans, cut off all relations with Assad, and he was left in the hands of Russia and Iran to pursue its intransigent approach. So we've been involved from day one to try and change the international community's behavior in Syria. Secondly, we were trying to change the conversation from day one of this conflict from when Assad is going to disappear to what that transition could look like. What is in this transition for all parts of the Syrian society to feel that this could be part of their country, still part of their country again? And since then, we've been trying, together with Syrian colleagues from across the political divides, from pro-government, pro-opposition, and most importantly, the middle of the Syrian society, the silent majority, civil society activists, together with them to develop a vision of what's transitional and future Syria could look like. We also tried through a very innovative program based on social media to document the Syrian conflict and to dispel myths that one side or the other was about to win this war, to dispel this myth that there can be victors and losers in this conflict, and yet we could see conflict resolution. So we've been involved from day one at very, very granular as well as a very top leadership level in trying to find a political path out of this conflict.
And has the people that you've been working with, the cross-section, it seems, of civil society and, mm-hmm. and from different groups, is there some sort of unified vision, or are there sort of different paths that people see? How would you characterize this?
I wish there was a unified vision. One of the biggest failure of the opposition in Syria has been to be so fragmented from day one of this conflict and continue to be fragmented throughout this conflict. Today, through our analysis and social media analysis that we develop, we've been able to document the formation and development of 7,000, I repeat, 7,000 opposition armed groups in Syria. Not all 7,000 exist today. Some of them have just died away. Some of them have given up the fight, disappointed. Others have merged with other organizations. But I would think that about 1,000 still different, distinct armed groups still exist in Syria today, from very Islamist ones to very nationalist, secular ones, who are assembled around perhaps 100 larger organizations still active in the Syrian conflict. The political opposition is also very much divided. Basically, too many leaders, members of the political opposition sold the revolution, sold the noble aims of changing Syria to the highest bidders, basically, whoever paid them most. And we end up with the mess we have now in Syria.
When we hear about negotiations at the UN, Vienna, and so on, who represents civil society? Not the armed groups, but who represents the
That's
people? Is there a coalition? Are there as many splinter groups as you mentioned, or how does that work?
There are two main negotiating parties in Geneva today, the government, obviously, and the opposition, which under Western U.S., Saudi, etc. pressure, formed a unified opposition negotiating committee. It's called the High Negotiating Committee. That met in December in Riyadh, formed this committee through pressure and bribes and what have you, formed this committee, unified negotiating committee, and came to Geneva for the negotiation. Out of this were left the Kurds. The Kurds are still outside of the tent. They're not part of the negotiations. But civil society, all credit due to Stefan de Mistura, who's the UN Special Envoy for Syria, in charge of these negotiations, he, from the back window and the back door, was able to bring in various civil society organizations into the tent as advisors, so to speak. But nonetheless, they're there inside the tent. One very strong thing that he did was to form a women's advisory board of various women's civil society organizations, very strong in Syria, doing unbelievably heroic work in Syria, and brought them into the tent as well as another group of Syrian civil society organizations trying to advise him formally, but really part of the negotiations, part of the consultations at the UN in Geneva.
And does this group have a unified vision, or once again, is it splintered as well as what it sees as Syria's future?
Look, they have different opinions on various issues, but on fundamental issues, they're unified. I've met with them on numerous occasions. Last time was just, what was it, 2 weeks ago when I was in Geneva. And on fundamental issues, they stand united. They're much, much wiser than their opposition colleagues, who are mostly men. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. what do you see as the biggest opportunities going forward for the possibility of peace?
Look, for the first time, we're cautiously optimistic that we're on the right path, on the path to peace in Syria. But it's going to be a very, very long path. It's not going to happen tomorrow. We're going to see setbacks in the course of these negotiations. We've seen already twice people have walked out of the negotiations and eventually come back. But the opportunity is that, look, the civil society, by and large, in Syria are sick and tired of it. And in fact, the fighters, the opposition fighters that we deal with, we work with them, we talk with them, are tired of this fight. They want this to end. The soldiers, the army, the Syrian army, the regime army, is tired of 5 years of war. It's depleted, exhausted. They can't continue anymore. And they all realize. And don't forget that the opposition commanders are former officers in the Syrian army. And they're still in contact with their former colleagues who are still in the army. And they talk to each other. They've told us, they've confided to us that they talk about how tired everyone is and how they should be ending. But they're supporters from outside, they keep still pushing for the zero-sum result, winners and losers. There are some who still believe, on the regime side as well as the opposition side, that they can win this war. One side can win. It can't. It cannot. Everyone has to be a loser in this conflict.
How has the Russian interventions, you know, since the past fall, changed the dynamics? Yeah.
Well, paradoxically, the Russian intervention, bombing everyone in sight who's not with the army, changed the paradigm in Syria. As I was told by a very high-level Russian official back in November when I was visiting Moscow, he said, "We came to Assad's help at his hour of need, the beginning of October, so that Assad can become flexible during the transition." This is the intention with which Russia came into Syria, and I suspect with the understanding of the U.S. Government. Otherwise, how can you explain that since the Russian intervention, Secretary Kerry and Minister Lavrov have been working hand in hand in trying to make sure that the ceasefire continues and this political process takes hold and negotiations continue in Geneva? I think Russia, despite the appearance of what happened in pounding everyone in the opposition, created the space for the ceasefire first and then eventually the negotiations to go forward.
Based on what you've seen, do you envision some kind of settlement in which Assad stays in power, either for the near or long term?
From day one of this conflict, when the international community was saying that Assad is finished and has to go from day one of the, before even the transition started, we were saying that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. It could not have happened because we know Assad. We've dealt with him. We've discussed with him. We've negotiated with him personally at his level. And Assad still has support in Syria. Whether we like it or not, has support in Syria. Has all the minorities basically supporting him in his Syria, in particular, of course, the Alawite minority, but also Christians supporting him. One thing that changed and allowed the October political changes to take place and the ceasefire to get hold and develop a minimum consensus on the political process forward was the fact that finally the international community reconciled itself to the fact that perhaps Assad will be part of the transition for a while and hope that at the end of the transition, the 18-month period, Assad would step away and a different kind of Syrian leadership would come in place. I would not be surprised if Assad is part of the transitional power-sharing government and continues in power until the new constitution takes hold within 18 months and new elections take place. One way in which Assad can leave and save face, and also his supporters, Iran and Russia, save face, is to change the system of governance in Syria from a presidential system to a parliamentary system in which a cabinet and a prime minister or a president of a council of ministers rules the country in more collective form than a single president, all the powers that single president has now. And that could be a face-saving way in which Assad can step down and say he doesn't want to be a figurehead president.
Because right now, under the current constitution, he has essentially all the power.
All the powers. I mean, executive, legislative, judiciary, you name it, he rules everything. I mean, and that's how the constitution is framed. And we've tried to develop alternatives and options for how the constitution could be changed so that a power-sharing arrangement in Syria could be made possible.
You mentioned before one of the best hopes is that people are so tired that people are finally willing to.
Yes.
What do you see as the biggest obstacles to moving forward for a peaceful?
Outside forces still hoping for a zero-sum outcome. Outside forces still promoting intransigence on one side or the other, both sides actually. Outside forces, whether they're governments or charities, foundations, or rich individuals funding parts of this war, parts of the various groups fighting in
And what are some examples of these various actors, outside actors?
I mean, who's funding some of the very hard-line Islamist forces in Syria? Saudi Arabia, Turkey, possible. And of course, let's not forget that Iran also is supporting the sectarian Shia militias from Hezbollah to others in Syria in support of the regime. One thing we need to remember in Syria, there are no clean hands. Everyone has made very, very fundamental serious mistakes in this war, including the international community. Huh? I'm not excluding the international community. All sides have committed very serious mistakes in this war and have caused hundreds of thousands of people to die. 2-3 years ago, when we were promoting some of the conclusions that they've come to now, they say, oh, yes, you were right 3 years ago. You know, some of the people we talked to, we should have come to that conclusion 3 years ago. But at least we've come to the conclusion now. Well, yeah, sure, $300,000 more people dead after 300,000 more people have died. Yes, you've come to the same conclusion.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. We're hearing from Harare Balian. He's director of the Conflict Resolution Program at the Carter Center. He's in conversation with Katie Zoglin, senior deputy city attorney of the city of San Jose. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now back to our conversation.
How does ISIS and al-Nusra fit into the power dynamics?
ISIS in particular, and perhaps al-Nusra also, Nusra Front also, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate, will most likely not be part of any political deal coming up. As you may know, the ceasefire arrangement does not apply to ISIS or al-Nusra. The war continues against them, and everyone has agreed that those are terrorist organizations. They have to be fought, and they have to be basically eliminated from Syria. But military force alone will not get rid of ISIS or Nusra. Nusra is divided internally. There are those who have been advocating that perhaps they should agree to this ceasefire and join the rest of the opposition, trying to join the power-sharing arrangements. Other in the Nusra front, the more al-Qaeda hardcore types want to continue the fight no matter what against the West, the Crusaders, etc. And ISIS, forget it. I mean, they don't want to talk with anyone. Us at the Carter Center, we talk with anyone willing to talk to us, because our philosophy is in conflict resolution. You don't exclude anyone from discussions if you want the conflict to be resolved. You have to talk with everyone. But we don't talk to ISIS because they're not interested. And secondly, no one can give me a guarantee that if I try to talk to them, my sons and daughter and sister will not see my head being chopped off on television. Okay, there's no guarantee to talk to them.
Right. Yeah. We'll turn now to some of the questions from you all. One person in the audience asks, specifically, how can the United States contribute to a peacekeeping mission in Syria? What would it take to convince the American people to send personnel, if you think that would be appropriate, to Syria?
You know, I cannot think of a single country today that is willing to contribute peacekeeping forces to Syria while there is ISIS still running around the country. And Jabhat al-Nusra is still running around the country committing unbelievable acts. Your best guarantor for a peacekeeper is peacekeeping mission is first a political agreement between the regime and the opposition, or the majority of the opposition, for a power sharing arrangement, and then those two forces joining forces together to combat ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. If the regime alone were to fight ISIS, we would not be successful. They would not be successful. The opposition, despite its 100,000 or so fighting force, cannot combat ISIS alone. The combined forces can start the fight, a successful fight against ISIS. The international community, the US-led coalition, cannot defeat ISIS through aerial bombardment. Has to be the combination of all those factors working together that would be able to fight ISIS and any other spoiler still itching for a firefight. But also Russia is the only country that has volunteered its forces to stay in Syria. They have interests. They want a base in Syria, naval base in Syria, now an air base in Syria. They're the ones who keep saying, we will be the guarantors of any peace agreement reached in Syria. Ideal situation, but...
Mm-hmm. We have many people asking about Russia's role in Syria. For example, what is the current role in Syria now with the supposedly reduced role of the military? Has it been reduced?
The Putin's announcement, President Putin's announcement a few weeks ago that Russia was reducing its forces in Syria or withdrawing its forces in Syria is at best a partial withdrawal, a very partial withdrawal. Russia, don't forget, is about 2 hours flight away from Syria. Whatever jets, fighter jets it withdrew from Syria, they can come back with a 2 hour notice. They're maintaining their two bases in northwestern corner of Syria, naval base and air base that they've built since October. They're willing to combat. Russia was giving a message to Assad by withdrawing or announcing the withdrawal of forces. Russia was giving a message to Assad that don't take our military involvement here for granted. We can withdraw and leave you alone to fight against ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra, and everybody else trying to depose you. So don't take us for granted, and therefore be flexible during the transition. And Russia has expressed several times in the last 2 months very, very deep frustration with Assad and company every time they've made intransigent announcements. So Russia is pushing towards this, towards a peace political process to end this war. But Russia also has red lines that we have to learn to respect, you know.
And what are those?
And the red lines are no regime change under Western pressure. They will not put up with it after Libya. They will not put up with it. We duped them into voting for a UN Security Council resolution under the responsibility to protect. Mm-hmm. And we went into jointly to Libya to put in place humanitarian assistance and turn this into a regime change operation. Russia would not fall for the same trap again. So no regime change under Western pressure, no jihadist takeover in Syria, and no state collapse in Syria. Those are Russia's three red lines. And of course, they want their bases to remain there for a long term. Those are its red lines.
People also ask how useful you see Russia's role to be in the whole, in coming to a peaceful resolution.
Look, if we continue the kind of cooperation that we've had in the last few months between Secretary Kerry and Minister Lavrov, with the approval of the two presidents in Obama and Putin, I think together they can play a very constructive role. What I'm concerned with is that the attention span, in particular for this country entering an electoral period, is going to be very short and very dangerous. We're entering a very slippery slope, very dangerous period in our political life in Washington. And how long will the administration be able to maintain this cooperation with Russia is a question mark in my head. But from my conversations with everyone in Washington, they seem determined to push on with this effort with Russia. So yes, Russia and the U.S. together can play a constructive role in Syria.
And
in particular, also bringing each side respectively, their allies, to bear pressure on the parties that they're supporting in Syria.
Another person in the audience asks, who funds the Syrian regime's armies?
Who funds?
Yes.
Russia and Iran. But even then, they're running out of funds. They're in really serious budgetary problems. A few months ago, the Syrian government asked for a $6 billion credit line from Iran, and Iran only gave $1 billion. Credit line.
Yeah. And what happened to the Christian minorities in Syria? Are they still there? Have they fled the country? Do they still support Assad?
I don't have statistics as to how many have fled, but a considerable number have fled for very, very good reasons. I mean, they've been under pressure, persecution. In ISIS-held areas, they've gone through massacres, beheadings. The churches have been destroyed or taken over, made into administration buildings, etc. The clergy have been kidnapped and killed. Bishops and archbishops have been kidnapped of various communities. I work with a group of minority religious leaders, religious leaders from across the sectarian divides, in a group called the Oslo group, discussing how minorities could remain in Syria and feel secure. They feel under huge pressure and threat. Many of them have left. Others are still there and still clinging to the regime. But some among the leadership of minorities are fed up with Assad's both incompetence for the way in which he's run the war and an inability to make any concessions to find some sort of a political accommodation with the other side. And even his own community, the Alawite community, signed a petition just a few weeks ago, less than a month ago, I can't remember exactly when it was, basically announcing that the Alawites and Assad are not the same thing. And these are the Alawite community leaders who signed up. I don't know what has happened to them, but they were courageous enough to come up and announce this publicly.
Just today, we heard an announcement that the United States is sending 250 more advisors to Syria. What do you think their roles will be? Do you think that will have any impact one way or the other?
It would not have much of an impact, frankly. It's a political move in Washington to placate some of those advocating U.S. military, heightened or increased U.S. military role in Syria. I don't think it's going to make much of a difference, really, in this fight. There is no military solution to this conflict. We have to repeat that on and on and on again. It has to be a political solution. And the more we pour weapons into the country on the opposition side, we meaning the U.S. and our allies, the more intransigent we make the opposition, and we feed them dreams that perhaps there is a chance that they can win this fight. There's no way.
Can a political power-sharing arrangement be established without ISIS first being defeated?
Yes, it has to be. The power-sharing arrangement has to be established before ISIS can even, the whole ISIS conundrum can be addressed. Because the united military effort against ISIS, on which any victory against ISIS depends, united meaning the Syrian forces united, depends on a power-sharing arrangement political at the political level in the first place, before the armies can join forces together.
I didn't know if we could focus a little bit more on, you touched upon the Kurds, Turkey and the Kurds. How do you see there's events taking place with the PKK as well as the PYD, you know, declaring itself autonomous. How do you see that impacting the situation?
The Kurdish organizations, both military and political, in Syria and Turkey, are independent organizations, yet very much linked together, in the same, sharing the same fate, really, in the two countries. So they do work together, they do cooperate together, though they pursue different aims. Their aim is not to unite and form a single country of Kurdistan between all these places, but they want autonomy. They want territorial autonomy in Syria to protect their rights, because don't forget they have been persecuted for decades in Syria and in Turkey, and they do have a common cause in trying to fight their respective dictatorships.
What is your prognosis for the presidential candidate's impact on the Syrian conflict?
Here,
yes. American, yes.
Do you want to get into that subject?
All right.
Need I say anything if Trump and company won? No. Frankly, I'm not too optimistic if Hillary wins.
And why is that?
She's been quite a hawk in the past when she was in the Senate and when she was a Secretary of State. I'm not sure, frankly. And that's my personal opinion. Yeah. It's not a Carter Center opinion. Yes. We are a nonpartisan organization.
Sorry. The audience made me ask that. So, do you see more international pressure being critical in pushing Syria towards peace, or is it more the internal actors? And if so, what might motivate whatever international critical players to really put the pressure on that'll do the job?
I mean, in the first place, the international community have to agree, as they've done in Vienna, finally, back in October and November last year, have to agree on how this conflict will end before they can put pressure on the Syrians also to come to an agreement around the same principles that they've developed in Vienna and then later in the Security Council Resolution 2254. You've got the roadmap there. There are still issues outstanding, not resolved. And the longer the international community can keep this united front on how to end this conflict, the more successful they will be to convince their respective proxies in Syria to do the same thing and bring this conflict to an end. But the international community is the key first among themselves. And in the international community, five countries have to agree together on how to end this: US, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. The rest will fall in place, with all due respect to the Europeans.
Just to follow up on the notion that Carter Center does speak with anyone who is willing to open up any lines of communication with ISIS, if that could be done safely.
We've tried, but we've failed. We have not been able to do this. We've also tried and come very close to opening a line of communication with Jabhat al-Nusra, the Al-Qaeda affiliate. But again, we failed there too. We have not been able to. If anyone among the international community or Syrians or anybody at some point makes communication possible with either one of these organizations, and as you said, security can be guaranteed, then we're open to talking with everyone.
We have an extreme pessimist in our audience. What if the war doesn't end? What would the worst case scenario look like?
Well, if this ceasefire falls apart, if the negotiations fail and fall apart, then we're in for at least another 5 years before we can come back to where we are today, if the war resumes again, full scale. And then we're looking to another 5 years before the war ends.
And
so we're talking about a 15-year war altogether.
Obviously, there's the humanitarian impact, which is horrific. Someone wanted to know, why should the international community continue to be involved in what's going on in Syria, taking out the humanitarian impact?
Look, this is the biggest humanitarian catastrophe, not even a crisis, a catastrophe that the world has seen since World War II. Half the population of a country of 23 million has been displaced. More than half have been displaced. Half the country's housing stock has been destroyed or heavily damaged. 570,000 people have been killed, 2.1 million injured, maimed, 10% of the population either killed or maimed. 2 million children have not seen school for the last 5 years in Syria, in and around Syria. 2 million children. What do you think is going to happen to these people? And shouldn't the international community be concerned about this? If you think last year's refugee crisis in Syria, and they're not migrants, they're refugees, you know, no matter how even informed media calls them migrant, it irritates the heck out of me. They're refugees. And if you think that was bad, wait until you see when the fighting resumes again. If the fighting resumes again, I shouldn't say when, God forbid. If the fighting resumes again, that's going to be child's play. Okay, they're going to flood not just Europe, but everywhere else. But just for humanity's sake, I mean, these people are in horrible conditions, really horrible conditions.
You mentioned that you were having discussions with the lawyer about perhaps, you know, transitions. One thing that I read I thought was very interesting, that some people, and I think the Carter Center has been talking about one of the prior constitutions that Syria had that apparently was a good one. I didn't know if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I mean, a lot of the opposition, various opposition groups advocate that for the transitional period, Syria should go back to a constitution that was adopted in 1950 in a relatively more democratic way. People voted on it. There was a referendum, sort of acceptable referendum in which they voted and put in place this constitution. And it was developed in a constituent assembly where experts and citizens from around the country had a say in developing this constitution. But it was 1950. I mean, a lot has happened since 1950. Governance concept have changed since 1950. Syria has signed 30, 40 international instruments, human rights treaties, and the international community has developed international treaties on various human rights issues since the 1950s. None of this are included in that constitution. What we've been saying is that take the current constitution as defective as it is. We've developed minimum amendments to that constitution only to allow for the transition to take hold, a power-sharing government to take place, and bring the country in a power-sharing arrangement from where it is today to 18 months from now when there is a completely new constitution, and then fundamentally change the country and have elections under the new constitution. But for the moment, when the government is unwilling to change anything, the opposition wants everything changed, let's just agree on minimum changes to the current constitution and allow the transition to move forward. That's what we need to accomplish, not much more. The more ambitious we are in changes for the transitional period, the more difficult will be the changes to be acceptable by everyone.
And could one say that there's parallel tracks going on about discussions about the Constitution transition and trying to stop the war, or is that not really a fair way to see it?
Well, both the U.S. and Russia have taken a lead on developing concepts of what the future constitution of Syria would look like. Our line has been that the Syrians have to decide it, not the international community. The more changes in Syria are Syrian-owned, the more successful the implementation of the changes would be. And the options of constitutional changes that we've developed it with Syrian colleagues from across political divides. We've brought in pro-regime people into our workshop, pro-opposition people, the middle civil society people who have no horse in this race, but a peaceful transition. And the armed groups, we've brought them into the discussion process together to develop the changes that they would like to see, the vision that they would like to see of changed Syria. It's really their product, what we have developed. Okay, we've facilitated this work for them. And despite what the US and Russia have done in the discussions 2 weeks ago in Moscow and last Thursday when I was in Washington, very high levels, they told us that, yes, we're all thinking about the same thing, but you guys have done much more work on this. You are much more advanced in this work than we are. And both sides, Russians and the Americans, have invited us to come to brainstorming sessions with a larger group of people in, not next week, the week after in Washington and a few weeks later in Moscow. And they've told us that, you know, the input that we've provided have enriched their own thinking, and they want us to do more of the same kind of work, as well as the UN negotiator.
One person in the audience asked, would the current situation be different or less dire if the United States had not invaded Iraq?
Well, the original sin. Yes. Unequivocal, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the reason Iraq is a failed state today is, yes, the 2003 invasion and what followed. And that has had repercussions in Syria. Daesh or ISIS owes its existence to the original sin of U.S. Invading Syria, Iraq in the first place.
One person in the audience wanted to follow, hear a little bit more about Aleppo. How did it become so destroyed? Was it forces on various sides, or is it one side or the other?
Look. When you have a war in an urban setting, the inevitable outcome is utter destruction all around you. I mean, add to this the fact that there are no two sides fighting each other. There are multiple sides fighting each other. Yes, on the regime side, the government side, it's pretty much united. But on the opposition side, you have so many forces fighting among themselves and against the government and against ISIS that the outcome is destruction of the city. And my fear was, before the October introduction of the Russian forces, my fear was that the opposition was on the verge of entering Damascus. They were on the gates of old Damascus. Okay, they were on the verge of entering Damascus. But the opposition was so divided still that my fear was that the only force capable of taking advantage of the chaos once the opposition entered Damascus would be ISIS. And Damascus would meet the same exact fate as Aleppo, Homs, Idlib, you name it. There's so many cities in Syria that have been destroyed, like Aleppo. We talk about Aleppo because Aleppo was the largest city in Syria.
One person was following up on your discussion about Turkey's support of ISIS. Would ISIS survive if Turkey did not support?
I did not say Turkey supported ISIS. I said Turkey let ISIS bring in its fighters from abroad through Turkey and crossing its 800 mile, or is it 800 kilometers? I forget, border between Turkey and Syria.
I think 911
Syria.
Is okay, where I read.
Good. Because thank you.
Because Turkey apparently is building a concrete
miles
wall.
Miles or kilometers?
Kilometers, yes.
Yeah.
thank you for that clarification.
But Turkey is also supporting a number of the opposition forces in Syria.
One person asked, is there a positive linchpin, like one sort of game changer that could happen to resolve the conflict?
Look, it happened already in October. In October, when the international community first included everyone with a stake in the conflict around the table in the discussion, and I'm talking about Iran, was included in the discussion. And second, that change took place when the international community developed the roadmap and a minimum consensus on how they wanted this conflict to end. There's still differences among the international community. But this started the process of a political process of ceasefire, negotiations, etc., and hopefully a power-sharing arrangement a few months down the line. It has happened already. The trick is not to allow this to fall apart, not to allow alarmists in the media and the neocons and a few others in Washington to scream that, oh, everything is falling apart, let's go back to supplying weapons to the opposition, let's create a no-fly zone in northern Syria, on and on and on, to go back to the war footing and ignore the political process and the gains made to date. And there are gains that have been made to date.
We have a number of students in our audience.
Yes, I met with them earlier.
Yes, and I know there a number of them are considering careers in international affairs. I didn't know if you might be able to share with them what inspires you to continue in your work.
Well, we talked about it earlier. I didn't tell them that if you expect to make money, don't get into this line of business. You will not get rich in this line of business. Forget it. But you'll make a decent living. But more importantly, you'll have the intellectual and moral satisfaction of having done something in your life. But it's not easy. As I said, it's a 24/7 work, and disappointments and failure are more the rule than successes. With all that, if you want to get in, come in. I'm ready to encourage you to get into this kind of work.
All right. To return just to a more serious note, on the one hand...
that was serious.
Yes. You know, we talk about the different countries and powers that you're saying are necessary players, but in some way does that then take the decisions out of the hand of the Syrians by including that?
No, that's not what I meant at all. What I meant is that with the different... sponsors and supporters of various groups in Syria, the Syrians themselves will never be able to reach a consensus and an agreement on how to move forward. Yes, this has to be a Syrian-driven process. It has to be the Syrians who would want to establish peace. But as long as the international community is not in agreement on minimum roadmap as to where the country should go and how this should end, there will be spoilers among the international community who would push one side or the other, or one group on one side or the other, to reignite the fire, as we've seen in the last 3-4 years. Yeah. There have been number of localized ceasefire arrangements that have never succeeded because there's always spoilers. And finally, we came to a point, and there are still spoilers, but finally we came to a point where a critical mass of the international community pushed a critical mass of Syrians to stop the fighting and start thinking.
Well, on that note, before we go to the floor for discussion with those of you who are in the room, I would like to say goodnight to our radio listeners. And thank Harar Balian for an excellent discussion.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of Conversations at the World Affairs Council. You can join us in our next conversation by visiting worldaffairs.org. This program featured Herrera Bellion of the Carter Center. He was in conversation with Katie Zoglin, Senior Deputy City Attorney in San Jose. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.